Time I'd like to call this House Resources Committee hearing together. Today is March 16th. The time is 1:13. We have Representative Gutenberg, Edgman, Olson, Co-Chair Johnson, Tuck, Kawasaki, Seaton, my friend Peggy Wilson, and myself, Chair Newman. We do have a quorum. When we last were here, we were discussing, it wasn't accepted, but we were discussing an amendment that was put forward by Representative Seaton, and I just wanted to have a little bit of discussion on that. Again, it was not accepted for committee, but or adopted, but I think Representative Seaton's got another idea that he's working on. And I think that we may have a little bit of a solution to everybody. We just had a discussion with the commissioner, Mr. Harding, to ask if the commissioner's office feels that they can come up with some language that will offer some type of an amendment or language that deals with the technology forcing aspect of the initiative. With the sense that the initiative wanted to make sure that industry would continue to try and advance the technology that they have to make sure that Alaska's waters are clean. And we've asked the commissioner again to do that. He thinks that he can have something by Wednesday for us. So I think that we've met some middle ground here. And I will work with the commissioner and the sponsor to make sure that we have that for Wednesday's hearing. So I would like to offer the committees a little bit of time. Committee members, there were some questions on what a mixing zone is and other questions like that from members. If we could have the commissioner or his staff answer those preliminary questions. But Representative Seaton, I'd like a comment from you. What do you think there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I've had conversations as well, and the whole process here is so that we make progress towards water quality. Not that we don't have that now, but with the 2010 date, the compliance date fast approaching, we need to do something. And so the point of the amendments have been to get us moving in that direction and still allow the industry to function as, you know, fully in all the ports. And Mr. Chairman, since we are going to be delaying, what I would like to do is offer an amendment to the amendment or a substitute amendment, whichever you prefer, just so that the that's out there in the public, so that the public can be looking at the issue as through the conversations we've had throughout the hall and with industry and with all the players, that we can have the greatest amount of information to the public.
Well, Representative Seaton, as our committee rules state, you know, we do not like to have amendments prior to 24 hours of the hearing. And I realized during committee discussion, you know, there's small amendments that we're going to do during committee discussion. But this is a five-page amendment. And if you want to distribute that to members of whoever, that's fine. And I would suggest you do that because I looked to a letter that we received from Mayor Weinstein of Ketchikan, and some of the concerns that they've got were some of these port-related developments are going to cost $25 to $30 million, you know, to upgrade some of their infrastructure, $20 to $40 million, and $1 to $3 million to operate them. One thing that I am concerned with too is, as the mayor of Ketchikan, he states, and I'm going to read this into the record. It says, "Furthermore, I have tried with little success to date to engage the initiative sponsors in a process to sit down and develop a fair way of distributing the proceeds of the passenger fees to benefit the ports of call actually impacted by the ships and their passenger crews. I'm still waiting to do that. However, I'm not willing, however, to have them tell us what our capital priorities should be." And that was by Mayor Weinstein of Ketchikan. So, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem like all the parties are trying to reach out to the communities that are truly affected by this, and that bothers me. So, again, if you would like to distribute some of their stuff, I hope I've put a little bit of pressure on the initiative sponsors and others to talk to the communities and people that are out there, any interested party, whether you're a cruise ship or owners or whoever you are, talk to these communities about how it affects them. Because they're talking to us, we're getting a lot of information back on there, but again, I don't want to accept that amendment right now. If it was a minor amendment, that's one thing, but it's certainly not fair for communities who are looking at impacts of $20 to $40 million on their economy to not have a say in this, you know, on that, so.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, and I would just like to, we're trying to have that same conversation, but if people are talking about a amendment that, you know, some of the provisions have definitely been changed, then they're commenting on past stuff instead of current. So I would just like to let the public know also that the revised amendment that I'd be offering is 26LS0570E.3, and I will post that on my website so that if people in communities want to know where we're at, I'm not moving that amendment per your request, but at least they'll know what the proposal has been modified to work with them. Thank you.
Representative Seaton, and I believe that if I remember right and looking at my committee notes here, that amendment number one was not accepted, but it was offered for discussion. Would you maybe it'd be more appropriate to offer this as amendment number two, I guess, so that people can get it on record. Representative Johnson, what's your opinion on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think just so that we have everything out in public, so that everyone can look at it, if you want to reintroduce one at a future time, Representative Seaton, I certainly think that'd be appropriate. If you withdraw one, offer two, I'll object, and at least then everything's on the table, and everybody knows what we're talking about, and you won't have to post it on your website, but it'll be available for anyone to look at through the state basis system, and I think that might be a more open and transparent way to do that as opposed to leaving it on yours, so that it's open to everyone. I'll maintain my objection until the bitter end, of course, but I certainly think that would be the cleaner way to get it on the record.
I think Representative Johnson, I'm not sure if amendment number one was offered and it was accepted.
It was
by the
offered,
committee.
But I objected. But okay. If he withdraws it, then he can offer two.
Okay, Representative Johnson. Representative Seaton, would you like to withdraw amendment one and offer number two? So we make sure the public is aware of what's going on.
Mr. Chairman, so we will offer, we have the opportunity to offer amendment number two at this time.
I'm going to let you offer it, okay. But we're not going to. I want the communities to be able to, we're not going to vote on it. Communities need to know what's out there. I'll let you bring it up for discussion is what I would probably like to do instead of offering it as an amendment, but to just offer it up for discussion.
Mr. Chairman, unless we move an amendment, we have nothing before us to discuss. Co-Chair Johnson is willing to object to the amendment, but I don't know how to do it if we just.
Mr. Representative Seaton, we can, during committee discussion, we can discuss anything we want. But we can do it that way. Well, would you like? Yeah. We'll just try and keep it easy,
sure.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to withdraw amendment number one this time. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer 26. LS0570/E-3 as amendment number two.
I'll object. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would move that we table amendment number two for committee discussion at this point.
Yes.
And then we can. At least it's on the record for everyone to see, and it's tabled, and then we can have committee discussion and work through some of these problems with the commission and Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, and that's I think exactly what we'll do, because now the communities can look at it. It's hard for them to discuss it and understand what's going on out there. And again, We'll offer it out there for discussion, because I know it's an important issue to the public. But generally, I'm not going to allow amendments like this to come through, you know, within a five-page amendment 20 minutes before a committee. But I want to make sure that it's a very important issue to the public. We'll allow it up there. We'll offer it, but we're not going to discuss it. We're going to hold it there so the committees, their members can look at it, and the public can look at it. And then maybe we'll bring it up on Wednesday. But I really want to make sure that we give the commissioner time to work on a solution that he feels meets the initiative, the goals of the initiative. And again, the DEC is our regulating authority on this issue. I think should take the lead on this. You know, I really think that the governor's office should take the lead on some of these issues, and this is one. And the commissioner said he's willing to do that, so let's give him a chance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gutenberg.
Just a motion on the tabling. That tabling, it takes it off the off the table until Wednesday's meeting, when we can bring it up.
Yes.
Just want to make sure. So can I address the proceedings of the committee? Not on that amendment.
Okay. Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you. As well as this amendment before us, the amendment, we're going to see coming back from possibly the commissioner, some new language, 24 hours on that as well. So we have an opportunity, as well as us and other members of the community, to look at that. And I'm very much interested in having the ability to walk through the amendment and being able to talk to regulators, not just DEC and the sponsors of the bill and the initiative, but also learning how some of these things work, some of the subfunds work, and things like that. So just continue a full broad spectrum of understanding this bill and this process would be appreciated.
Okay. Right now, Commissioner Harding, could you please come to the table?
Yeah, my name's Larry Hartig, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Commissioner Harding, there were some questions that have to do with mixing zones and how they work. Can you explain them to the committee members?
Well, with me online, I believe, is Lynn Kent, our Director of Water, the Water Division. Are you on, Lynn?
Yes, I am.
Lynn, are you there? This is Lynn Kent from the DEC. Please state your name and affiliation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lynn Kent. I'm the Director for the Division of Water at the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Lynn, could you please talk to us about how mixing zones work?
Absolutely. Maybe I'll start with just a little bit of background information. The first thing that DEC does is set water quality standards. So for each type of contaminant, be it a metal or an organic or whatever kind of substance, we set a specific numeric limit for most of those parameters that is designed to protect the use of a water body. So I like to use the example of copper, because that's probably the most or the least intuitive. So for copper, we set a numeric limit that is designed to protect human health for drinking water purposes. We also set a numeric limit for protection of aquatic life. The aquatic life standard happens to be more stringent because aquatic life is more sensitive to copper than humans are. So then when we get to the permitting stage and we have a wastewater discharger that has copper in their discharge, DEC looks to the criteria and we select the most stringent criteria. So in this case, for copper, it would be the aquatic life criteria. And that's what we base our permits on. We also look at, maybe I should stop there for just a minute and then switch to the mixing zone regulations. But you need a little bit of background first on the water quality standards. So for a mixing zone, even with the best treatment technology, the wastewater that's discharged from a variety of facilities, sewage treatment facilities or industrial facilities that include, you know, mining, seafood processing, oil exploration, what have you, sometimes even with the best treatment technology, those discharges still have low levels of pollutants in them after the water is treated. So the area where treated wastewater is allowed by DEC permit to mix with the water body is called a mixing zone, and we only authorize those in the context of a permit. And all of our permits, of course, go through a public review and comment period. So getting to how they work, the regulations that DEC has to consider when we are authorizing a mixing zone are designed to protect aquatic life, among many other things. So in order for us to authorize a mixing zone, we have to make about 19 different findings via our regulations. And the first one is that we have to ensure that the effluent is treated to remove, reduce, and disperse pollutants using the most effective, technologically and economically feasible methods, and at a minimum are consistent with statutory and regulatory treatment requirements. And then there are a whole host of other requirements, like ensuring that the mixing zone is as small as practicable, ensuring the overall biological integrity of a water body isn't impaired. We have to ensure that mixing zones don't preclude or limit established processing activities, commercial sport, personal use, or subsistence fisheries. We have to verify that they won't result in any reduction in fish or shellfish population levels. They can't affect endangered or threatened species. Mixing zones can't form a barrier to migratory species. They can't contain bioaccumulative contaminants. So I'm not going to go through all of those, but there are a whole host of regulatory requirements before we can even authorize a mixing zone. So what do they look like, I think, was one of the questions that I was asked at the last hearing. And the commissioner may have with him, I'm not sure, a copy of some examples of what mixing zones actually look like. And I'm sorry, it's a short fact sheet, and there are three examples on that fact sheet. One of them is for a shore-based seafood processing facility under a general permit. And this mixing zone is for residues, dissolved gas, oil and grease, pH, color, turbidity, fecal coliform, chlorine, and temperature. And that permit defines this mixing zone that's in marine waters as a cylindrical volume with a horizontal radius of 100 feet from the diffuser and the full depth of the water body. So you can think of it as a cylinder volume of water from the surface down to the bottom of the ocean there where that discharge occurs. And again, all of the water quality standards that the mixing zone is authorized for have to be met at the edge of that mixing zone. Let's see, another example, because it's an interesting one. This is the wastewater treatment plant in Juneau at the Mendenhall plant, not the Juneau Douglas plant, but the Mendenhall facility. This one's for fecal coliform, dissolved oxygen, bacteria, pH, metals, nutrients. This one is defined as an area within a rectangle. I'm sorry, this one goes into the Mendenhall River. It's defined as an area within a rectangle centered over the diffuser, so that's the end of the pipe. It has a width of 30 meters and extends both upstream and downstream because it's a tidally influenced river. So it goes up and down from the end of the pipe for a distance of 150 meters and for the full depth of the river. And this one provides for a dilution of 10 to 1. So I'm going to just pause there for a moment and see if that's responsive to the question or if you need some additional examples.
Thank you, Ms. Kent. Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you. So the Mendenhall glacier or the Mendenhall facility allows for a dilution of up to 10 to 1, and it has to meet the discharge water qualities at that point with a dilution of 10 to 1. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. The water quality standards have to be met by 150 meters downstream and upstream, depending on the tidal stage of the end of the pipe for that facility.
Follow up.
Representative Seaton.
But the design of that is for a 10-to-1 dilution?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kent, typically at the end of a mixing zone for the cruise ship boats, what is the ratio? The standard ratio is
Mr. Chairman, for a cruise ship that's underway, the vessel is 50,000 to 1.
50,000 to 1?
Yes, it's a very high dilution rate, and that's because the vessel is moving and there's a lot of turbulence.
Okay.
The mixing occurs almost instantaneously.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kent. Representative Seaton.
So just for clarity, the actual, let's say we're talking about metals, if it's a 50,000-to-1 dilution ratio by the end of the vessel, and you allow a 10-to-1 dilution ratio maximum for the Mendenhall, then you're talking about 5,000 times more dilution in the cruise ship discharge. So you could look at that in reverse and say you could meet the same water quality standard at the end by having 5,000 more times concentration of copper at the discharge point, because you'd be allowing that 50,000-to-1 dilution ratio by the end of the vessel. Are those calculations basically correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I'm not sure I followed all of your math there, but I will say that the water quality standards and our regulations governing mixing zones, both our anti-degradation policy and the mixing zone regulations don't allow us to let a cruise ship reduce the level of treatment that they're already able to achieve on their vessel. So we couldn't, for instance, if mixing zones were allowed by the pending bill HB 134 or any other bill for cruise ships, we couldn't allow any backsliding of the treatment level that the cruise ships have already been able to achieve just because we have the ability to authorize a mixing zone. They still have to meet that highest treatment technology available requirement.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was it Lynn?
Yes.
Yeah. Lynn, for the, so in this instance, what is the, what are the cruise ships doing now? I mean, are they all doing something different? Or because you said that you weren't allowed to let them slide back if they've got up 50,000-to-1, is that what the requirement is for all of them?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's the dilution that we've calculated doing dilution studies. The permit that the cruise ships have right now for wastewater discharges have, the permit has both interim limits in it and what we called long-term limits that take effect in the year 2010. The long-term limits are based on meeting the water quality standards at the point of discharge. The interim limits are based on roughly what the cruise ships are able to attain today.
Representative Wilson, follow up.
Please follow up. I guess what I'm asking is, some cruise ships meet this and some don't. So what is the standard then? I mean, what for a mixing zone, what would be a dilution? Or if some of them are meeting it and some of them aren't, I don't understand your numbers.
Yeah, Representative Wilson, through the chair, the cruise ships are not meeting the long-term effluent limits right now. I think you also were asking about what kind of treatment they have. The ships use a variety of advanced wastewater treatment systems that all produce a pretty high level of treatment on the water, but none of them achieve the water quality standards at the end of pipe for all parameters at all times.
Okay.
And Ms. Kent, that's, I think, part of the discussion is the word you said, end of pipe, and the allowing the DEC to use mixing zones as they typically do. Is that, am I reading that correct?
Yes, to the chair. The HB 134, the original bill that deletes the language at the point of discharge, would allow DEC, under certain circumstances, to authorize a mixing zone. Again, we couldn't allow the vessels to discharge concentrations of contaminants that are higher than what they're discharging now, but it would give a little bit of flexibility on where we measure compliance for those discharges.
Thank you. Any more questions? Representative Tuck, you had some questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. At one time, I asked at the last meeting that we had the difference quality of water standards, and you just hit up on copper just recently. Can you give us an example what copper levels would be for drinking water versus aquatic life water standards?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I did look up the various levels. I didn't look up drinking water because marine waters are not protected for drinking water, and of course the cruise ships all discharge to marine rather than fresh water. But what I can give you is an example. Let's see, that's not a good one either. if you can stand by for a minute, I can grab my book and look that up for you.
Okay, thank you. And the reason why I asked the question is because I know that some cruise ships are taking on more copper levels because they're only meeting the drinking water standard versus how much they're discharging. It's supposed to be a lot less than that, and I just was kind of curious what the difference would be.
Again, through the chair, I can tell you that the level, the water quality standard for protection of aquatic life is significantly more stringent than the copper criteria for protection of human health in drinking water.
Yeah, I think that pretty much said it.
Okay.
Okay, any more questions for Ms. Kent?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck?
Thank you very much on mixing zones. Our ships, they may have different technologies on each ship. Are you using the same mixing zone standards? Would you be using the same mixing zone standards for all ships, or is it based on the technology that particular ship may have?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, the mixing zones are based on the water quality standards and what's happening in the water body, more so than they're based on the type of technology that's available on the vessel. In all other instances, our water quality standards and our mixing zone regulations apply to the impact on the water body as opposed to who the discharger is. So our regulations are blind to whether or not the discharge is coming from a community system or an oil and gas facility or a seafood processor. Cruise ships are the only place where the law actually directs us to look directly at the type of discharger.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when it comes to cruise ships, you're talking about you're mostly focused on the water body. Would that mixing zone change depending on what water body that they're involved in?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, absolutely. From the dilution studies that we've done so far, it's pretty clear that a vessel that's using an advanced wastewater treatment system and is discharging underway, the mixing zone would be so small as to be almost immeasurable by us. There are certainly instances where if there's a discharge in a protected water body without a lot of flow, where a mixing zone could very well be denied.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically there's two criteria. One is the water body, and then am I hearing you correctly that it's also the technology that a particular ship may have?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, we're focused on the impact to the water body. So whether or not we authorize a mixing zone will be based on the characteristics of the water body, the flow, the characteristics of the effluent, the tidal stages, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, just one last
one.
Most of the ships that we have serving Alaska's waters, do they continually discharge, or do they have holding tanks where they can discharge where needed to be?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, there's a variety of capabilities in terms of the different vessels. Some of them have the capability of holding while they're in Alaska waters without having to change their itineraries, and some probably could not hold all of their wastewater while they're in Alaska waters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Ms. Kent? Ms. Seaton?
Thank you. The chart that you provided previously on mixing zones where it compares 2002 to 2006, and I'm curious about the interim levels. The 2002 for cruise ship, it showed I see where I'm looking at two different sides there. Never mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seaton.
Any other questions for Ms. Kent? Thank you. Bring it back to the commissioner. Do we have any quick questions for the commissioner? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I would just like to, you know, get the commissioner to direct us in what way he's looking at providing ongoing improvement of technology and improvement of, and make sure we maintain our water standards and the effect of directing towards better water quality standards and what we're going to look at on Wednesday so that we have some idea of that direction, if that would be.
Representative Seaton, I don't speak for the commissioner, but I believe that's a standard he's held to by statute. Commissioner?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. The administration recognizes that the people that voted for the initiative were expecting to raise the bar, you know, for the cruise ship discharge. The issue, though, is that the bar perhaps was raised too high. You know, they can't, the cruise ships, based on the technology reviews that we've done and talking with industry and talking with the vendors that supply the treatment systems at a conference that we had a month ago, there seemed to be consensus around that they can't meet all water quality criteria in the pipe. And so the question is where then should the bar be set? And the problem that we see is a lack of good science and engineering and economic information. You know, people are interested in perhaps onshore treatment. People are interested in, you know, more sophisticated systems. But there's just a lack of competent information that we can use to say, you know, where that bar could be set, you know, if it should be set higher and how long it would take to get there. And so what we're looking at as we approach discussions with the sponsor and whoever else we're directed to speak with here is look at how do we gather that information to make good judgment on where technology forcing would be appropriate and how it be done under what terms. And that's what we're mainly looking at is gathering, you know, a good science, engineering, economic foundation to operate from. And we don't want to lose sight, you know, as we see it, you know, what the initiative was trying to achieve is looking at can we raise that bar, you know, without driving industry completely out of the state. And so I think it's going to take some steps to get there. It isn't going to be something where there's a silver bullet. I think if there was a silver bullet, we would have found it at the technology conference or earlier. But it's going to be, you know, how we approach this analysis and get back with reasonable options to explore further. And that's what I see as the focus of the discussion that we'll be having with the sponsor and others. And maybe it was a little too broad of a statement to say we're taking the lead here. What we're offering up is to engage ourselves to try to add an element, you know, to HB 134 that we think is more in line with the expectation of the initiative, and that is some element of technology forcing here.
And Commissioner, I asked you to somewhat take the lead on this one, because we've got an initiative, a ballot initiative, that you've said that sets the standard too high, that it's not achievable. And when you said that, I wrote those words down because I thought that was
at this time it's not achievable.
At this time it's not achievable. And then so Representative Harris introduced a bill that he thought would work on that one. And now we have Representative Seaton who wants to impose regulations on communities throughout Alaska on land-based wastewater treatment plants. So we've got a couple of different things trying to intercede here, and that's why last week I asked Representative Seaton, you know, I thought it would be better if he brought his amendment forward as a separate bill, because his deals with land-based wastewater treatment plants. The initiative dealt with cruise ships. I think the Representative Harris tried to deal with the cruise ship initiative in allowing DEC the authority to regulate those, because that's what it does. It says DEC write the rules to make sure Alaska's waters stay pristine, and that's gives you the authority to do that. That said, Commissioner Harding, do you think that DEC can make sure that Alaska's waters stay clean? I mean, that's what it's about. Everybody wants Alaska's waters clean, whether it's the cruise ship industry or everybody sitting at this table. We want to make sure Alaska's waters are clean, that our fisheries are not affected. Can you do that?
Yes, Co-Chair Newman, that would be our intent, and we believe that with the regulatory tools that we have, you know, any mixing zone we authorize, you know, whether it's for a cruise ship or anybody else, are going to have to meet a high standard. And as Lynn Kent was mentioning, we have those 19 criteria, and we do go over those carefully. We would not be sacrificing Alaska's water quality for any industry.
And Ms. Kent, I'll get to you in just a minute here, Representative Wilson. Ms. Kent also said that you are required to use continue upgrading your regulations to make sure that the most efficient equipment is used on industries working within Alaska, no matter what industry that is. So you already do continue to make sure that the most advanced technology is incorporated, correct?
Yes, Chair. We have two regulations that you refer to, our anti-degradation provisions that would apply to any permit, even ones that don't have mixing zones. And then if we authorize a mixing zone, there's a separate requirement in there that we make sure that they're both doing waste reduction before they do treatment, and then when they do treatment, they're using, you know, the current available most efficient technology. We don't have provisions at this point, though, that look out further, you know, beyond the current horizon. And again, that's an element of the initiative that we think is there. You know, that's something that came out of the technology conference, that, you know, there may be some technologies down the road. We don't know exactly how far, but what I would look at is, you know, how do we go about exploring those, again, exploring, you know, looking at the science and engineering questions, you know, so that we can firm up our understanding of when those might appear and, you know, if there's some way we can encourage those, what those ways would be that would make sense in Alaska.
And that's what you expect to bring back to us, I hope. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, it's been stated, and we all accept that the standards for humans doesn't have to be quite as high as it is for fish. And, of course, in my part of the state, I'm really concerned about humans, of course, but also about the fish, because fishing is our main, you know, income for most of my people. And we know that the fish take a higher standard, but do we know exactly how high the copper can be before it starts affecting the fish? I mean, scientifically, do we know those exact numbers?
Yes, through the chair, first I might say that Ms. Kent was only talking about copper. It's not always true, you know, that the standard is more strict for aquatic life than it is for drinking water. Sometimes it's the other way.
Oh.
And there's different standards set for each contaminant. Sometimes we call them parameters, but same thing, a pollutant, a contaminant. And what we do is, you know, science is progressing all the time. Just as we're talking about treatment systems here and potential treatment systems, you know, there's those that are advancing. Our knowledge of what the effects may be on humans or aquatic life of various pollutants increases all the time, too. And under our regulations, which are based on a federal requirement of the Clean Water Act, we have to revisit our standards a minimum of every 3 years. We do what we call a triennial review. And we go out and we solicit recommendations from the public. We talk to the other agencies. We talk with the federal agencies. We look at what other states are doing. EPA provides its guidance to the states of what standards it thinks it needs. States need to look at again with new science. And we do that every 3 years and see what ones we need to update based on new information. And so it's a constant process of updating those.
Thank you. And Representative Wilson, it does my heart good to know you're so concerned about all the sport fishing in your district. Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was the technology conference that was here earlier in the year. From what I understand, I wasn't able to attend, but it was quite an event. About the technology available to do the water quality at higher standards. Is it the technology's not there, or is it the engineering's not there yet? And kind of the overall about these things, I mean, what was the consensus on water quality?
Yeah. If I may, Chair, I would refer that question to Ms. Kent again, and she may have one of our engineering consultants with her, too. I could answer it, but you might get a better answer from her.
Ms. Kent?
Thank you, Representative Gutenberg, through the chair. We did hold a technology review conference in mid-February, and one of the things that we learned is that there's certainly technology available that will treat wastewater to meet our water quality standards at the point of discharge. We can do it in a lab, and we can do it with very sophisticated equipment. What we also learned is that sizing it and conducting the engineering necessary to put it on board a cruise ship in very confined spaces is a bit of a challenge, and while no one is saying it can't be done, it is challenging and will take a little bit of time.
Thank you, Ms. Kemp. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we, Commissioner, do we have, phrase this, do we have a fair amount of data now to at least have a general understanding what the cumulative impacts are, and back to the question about copper, what that sort of all added up, what that does to the marine environment where the cruise ships operate?
Specifically on copper is the question?
And all the other elements as well, if you want to answer that together.
We have done some studies, and again, I'll refer you to Ms. Kent for the results of those studies. And
Ms. Kent, and if members would please go through the chair to make sure our clerk stays straight here. Ms. Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, DEC has been conducting some dilution studies over time here. We've looked at dilution studies EPA has done on moving vessels, and we conducted our own studies on stationary vessels. And for moving vessels, as I mentioned before, the dilution is very high, and our ability to even monitor for cruise ship waste in behind the vessels if they're underway is virtually impossible. The studies that we conducted last summer in Skagway, we were looking at field data to look, or collecting field data to calculate dilution that might occur under the worst case scenario. So Skagway being a very, sometimes very quiescent area, we were looking at cruise ships that were in a confined area with very limited flushing. So we kind of looked at that as our worst case scenario. And even in the worst case scenario, under some of the assumptions you might make about the data, our water quality standards would be met within 15 meters of a vessel that's discharging in that kind of a situation. Using other assumptions, specifically the very highest values that have been recorded in the last year from cruise ship discharges, it would take greater than 15 meters from the vessel to meet our water quality standards. And that's why I mentioned earlier that we would be if we had the ability to authorize mixing zones for cruise ships, we'd be looking at very specific water bodies and situations where a mixing zone would not have a negative impact on the water quality.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Edgman.
Thank you. So what I'm hearing you saying then, that in terms of a overall or a cumulative impact, it's still in terms of DEC's understanding a work in progress. Is that correct?
Representative Edmund, through the chair, I guess what I'm saying is in terms of cumulative impacts from vessels underway, we don't think there's a problem.
Okay, thank you.
Is that right? Did you just say that in terms of vessels underway, there's not a problem with the different minerals that Representative Edmund asked about?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. From a discharge perspective of vessels underway, there's not a cumulative impact from those vessels.
Commissioner or Ms. Kent, there's been a question out there, and people have brought this up, so I want to ask maybe the commissioner directly. If we were to take a glass of water from right out of the faucet here in Juneau and dump that overboard, would that meet the point of discharge requirements that are required on the boats right now?
I'll give that one to Ms. Kent, and then I'll answer if I need to, if that's okay with the chair.
Ms. Kent?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I didn't look exactly at the Juneau data, but there are points of call where the bunkered water, water that would be delivered to cruise ships, is higher in copper than the aquatic life criteria that's designed to protect the aquatic life in the water body that it's being discharged to. So, again, the if you had a mixing zone authorized for your glass of water, there probably wouldn't be a problem given the dilution factor. But let me point out that all of our shore-based wastewater treatment facilities do have authorized mixing zones. So if they have a drinking water source that might exceed the water quality standards in the receiving water, that's usually dealt with through the mixing zone or through the treatment process.
So could you kind of explain that in a more of a yes or no? Commissioner?
Well, I was going to add that we are requiring what we call source reduction evaluations by the various cruise ship companies, looking at how they can reduce their intake of copper and other pollutants of concern. And one of the things some of them have done is looked at where they get their bunkered water, because it can have an impact. And they're also looking at switching out, and some have, the piping in their own vessels. When we talk about copper in a community system, and Ms. Kent can add to this, is, you know, it can be the copper in the pipes, and it's not necessarily their water source. And so when you say draw that water, it may depend on where you draw it. You know, has it been standing in the pipes a while, or is it coming through some pipes where water's continually passing through there and any copper is being regularly flushed out? You know, so I don't want to be over technical, but when you ask that question, you know, it kind of depends on where you draw it, from whose system, and how long it sat, the water sat in the pipes, and some other good things.
So, Commissioner, the main source of a lot of the angst of some of the members here being copper comes right from the community water systems where they draw their water from. It's not coming from the boats so much. It's the water. It's where they get the water, the water that the people in those communities drink. Is that right?
And it's something, too, that, again, is a source of copper on these vessels that they're looking at and reducing the copper, you know, that they're discharging is where they bunker their water.
You're getting kind of slippery on me here, Commissioner. Another question. I'm going to go back and ask one more time, and if you can just answer it. Now, if I was to take a glass of water from Juneau and dump it overboard, would it violate the mixing zone requirements that are now the standard set in the initiative?
Would it meet water quality criteria at the point of discharge?
Yes.
To be honest, I don't know what those water quality parameters are. We can look at that question. We can look at, and we'll get that for you, you know, so we can answer that question definitively. You know, what data we have on the drinking water in Juneau and compare that to marine discharge standards.
Yeah, I think we've received some information that says most of the communities at the ports of call that it would violate those mixing zone at the point of discharge. That's an interesting standard that we're drinking that water ourselves. So any other questions for the commissioner?
Yes, Representative Tuck. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, when the initiative was originally passed, was it the DEC that gave the extension? And if so, what were the conditions that the DEC did that? And is it possible for the DEC to continue and to add more time to for the cruise ships to meet the water quality standards set by the initiative?
Yes, Representative Tuck, through the chair. The 2010 deadlines referred to did come from DEC. The initiative would have required the cruise ships to meet water quality standards in the pipe much earlier. The reason that we extended that deadline again is because just on the data that we had on discharges from cruise ships, we knew they weren't going to be able to meet it. We knew that they would need more time to try to find a technology or do source reduction, you know, to get to the standard. There is statutory and regulatory authority that DEC has to put compliance schedules in discharge permits. But when we do that, we have to be able to say that we're also inserting a schedule that would lead towards compliance and that has definitive steps to get one there. And so when we issued the first permit, the general permit for cruise ships, we put a schedule in there which we thought would be the minimum time, 2 years, you know, to reach water quality standards into pipe. And then we put some steps in there, and they weren't too well defined because we didn't know what those steps were ourselves. But we required this source reduction evaluation, and, as you know, from the cruise ship companies, you know, what they had in their discharge and where it was coming from, and, you know, what steps they saw to reduce that. They had to periodically report to that and show progress to us on that. And then we had the technology conference. And the technology conference that we had last February, one of the main purposes of having that conference was so we knew, you know, if we had to extend that 2010 deadline, you know, because it's coming up, and they need at least a year or two in advance to know, you know, we were going to extend that deadline. I didn't know how far to extend it. You know, is there something out on the horizon that would get them there? You know, if they have to meet the end of pipe requirement, how long would it take? You know, what steps, interim steps would be? And just try to give us a better picture of that. So the short answer is, yeah, we could extend it, but I have to have a good statutory basis for doing it. You know, showing that they could come into compliance over time and what those definitive steps would be. And that's what we're still searching for.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, if I understand the situation right now, that we do have the technology and engineering available to do it on land, but because cruise ships only have so much space available, that the on-land stuff is so big that they can't put it on a cruise ship, and so we're hoping that the engineering and the technology together can get it so it's smaller so we can get it on a cruise ship. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
I think that's, through the chair, I think that's an oversimplification. There's also energy requirements, and but maybe I can refer that one again to Ms. Kent, who's to answer, give a more definitive answer.
Ms. Kent, do you want to take a shot at that one?
Well, we, Mr. Chairman, we do have our contractors who ran the technology conference for us, and their subcontractor who's very familiar with the shore-based systems, and they might be able to speak to the technical requirements there of what it takes to take something from a shore-based application to a vessel application better than I can.
Yeah. I think, too, what some of the driving force, Representative Wilson, is, like we heard from the mayor of Ketchikan, is the prohibitive costs on these. But we do have Ronaldo Gonzalez, who might know a little bit more about this and how these are done, if that helps.
No, I meant.
Representative Wilson.
But yeah, I meant we can do it on shore. And I know how expensive it is, but I want to, I'm asking why we can't do it on the ships yet. And so it's not only space, but energy things we have to deal with.
Representative Wilson, we do have a gentleman by the name of Renato Gonzalez who knows a little bit about how those operations work. So, Mr. Gonzalez, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Could you answer Representative Wilson's question?
Yes, I will try.
name and
Yes, my name is Reynaldo Gonzalez. I'm with Burns & McDonnell Engineering, and we're sub by Oasis Consultant and a sub of ADAC to provide information about technologies available on land for treatment of metals, specifically copper, zinc, and nickel, and also ammonia. And what we have provided was our experience in treating those metals to levels close to the 2010 standards and sometimes lower than those in installations on base, and same case for ammonia. However, we haven't had any experience with all those compounds are combined, and also land installations space is normally not an issue. It's very hard to, and very challenging to try to feed or find the ways of bringing this technology into a ship, not only because of size also, but there are a lot of standards that the ship industry has that are completely different from the standards on land base. We don't know so far of any cruise ship that is has installations that can comply with all these standards when all these waste, all these compounds are combined in a wastewater. So we also were thinking that some treatability or pilot testing might be required to be sure it's going to work. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ronaldo.
Thanks.
Any other questions for the commissioner? Representative Gutenberg.
Mr. Commissioner, just I'm going to give you an opportunity to probably have a yes or no answer, but when we go down the road later on, we might have a discussion on appropriations out of the sub-account. Do you have any influence or control, or does any money that flow through DEC, or is that all just right into the general fund? I'm asking you so I don't have to come back and ask you that later.
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, there is the cruise ship tax that was there before the initiative,
mm-hmm.
and some of that money currently funds our permitting program at DEC. And so when we're looking at, for instance, the technology conference that we just did and activities like that, you know, looking at that as a potential source. And that's different than the $4 a head tax.
Thank you.
And Ms. Kent could go into that further if you'd like.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Heaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just trying to get, I don't quite remember the background. We've been talking about the advanced wastewater treatment plants used on the cruise ships in Alaska. Were those instituted because the cruise ships just wanted to upgrade? Were those the result of DEC regulation? Were those a result of an initiative, or were those a result of a legislative action that required that? What was the background of this?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that was before my time. I'll try to see if Lynn Kent can answer that one, but I don't have the background on that.
Ms. Kent?
Thank you, Representative Seaton, through the chair. Some of it was before my involvement, but and Denise Koch is there, I believe, with the commissioner, who will remember the sequence of events, but there was a time when there was significant public interest in cruise ships and discharges from cruise ships, and the companies met voluntarily on a work group with DEC and members of the public to look at the cruise ship discharges, the quality of those discharges. They voluntarily conducted sampling. And in the end, we went forward with legislation that the cruise ship industry was involved in and endorsed at the same time we were endorsing it. And that became the regulatory scheme for the initial DEC regulation. There were federal actions occurring at about the same time, but I don't remember the sequencing there. But it initially was a voluntary effort on the cruise ships to come in and talk to us about their wastewater discharges and to evaluate them and to make decisions to significantly upgrade the treatment treatment capabilities.
Sounds like a very good way of doing business, everybody working together.
Yep.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner. I think what we'll do now, again, Commissioner, if you come back with information for us, work with the sponsor and work with the chair on this one. And again, we're gonna let the DEC do their job. That's what their job is. So with that said, today's meeting is adjourned. The time is 2:12.